What do a 35-year-old monster-catching game, an AI that lives right on your desk, and a $130 million crypto heist all have in common?
Well, they are all proof that the cloud era is basically ending.
Right.
And that the heavy lifting of the tech world is landing right back in your lap.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. I'm really excited to get into this one.
Me too.
Yeah.
Because we are looking at a fundamental reversal of how we've lived digitally for, you know, the last decade.
Yeah.
The era of the universal centralized platform doing literally everything for you is fracturing. It's turning into something hyper-local and highly specialized.
And today we are mapping out that exact shift. We're pulling from a really great stack of sources featured in the second week of August 2026 edition of the Tekin Morning Newsletter.
It's a great issue.
It really is. So our mission today is to look at this massive industry-wide transfer of computing power, creative control, and honestly, data ownership.
Right. Taking it from the centralized giants directly to you, the end user.
Yep. And it's happening across entirely different sectors simultaneously, which is wild.
It is wild. And, you know, it brings unprecedented freedom to anyone willing to adapt. But
there's always a catch, right?
Always a catch. It also introduces a massive surface area for new, deeply personal risks. When you remove the giant corporation acting as your middleman, well, you also remove your safety net.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the variety in these sources is just crazy.
Oh, yeah.
We are tracking a legendary gaming studio completely abandoning its safety blanket, AI models bypassing the cloud to run right in your home office, a web browser engineered exclusively for robots.
Which is fascinating, by the way.
Super fascinating. And finally, a heist that proves the physical security devices you trust might be compromised before you even take them out of the box.
It really is a pattern of extreme democratization. Tech is no longer trying to be one size fits all.
Right. It's specializing.
Exactly. It's becoming incredibly niche, forcing the user to take a much more active role in how these tools are deployed.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's start with legacy systems breaking their own molds. Because the gaming industry is currently providing, like, the best blueprint for this specialization.
Oh, absolutely.
So for anyone familiar with the studio Game Freak, you know they have basically done one thing since 1989.
Right, Pokemon.
Exactly, Pokemon. They are the undisputed architects of the turn-based monster-catching formula. But on August 4th, they dropped Beast of Reincarnation.
Yeah, their first non-Pokemon AAA release.
Right.
And they completely abandoned the family-friendly turn-based mechanics they built their entire empire on.
It's so unexpected. I mean, it's a gritty post-apocalyptic action RPG following a protagonist named Emma and her dog, Koo.
And it launched day one on Xbox Game Pass.
Day one. And it's scoring really well. It's got an 82 on Metacritic for the PS5, and it's sitting at 87% positive on Steam.
That's incredibly solid for a genre pivot.
Right. Because it features punishing, Souls-like combat. We're talking heavy attacks, dodge rolls, intense stamina management.
They even brought in veteran Pokemon composer Gowan and Chinos to do the soundtrack.
Which is awesome. But I look at this pivot and I have to push back a little. I just wonder how a studio that only knows slow, menu-based combat manages to pull off a punishing, real-time action game without it feeling incredibly clunky.
Right. I mean, this is like a Michelin star pastry chef suddenly opening a gritty Texas BBQ joint.
Yes. That is the perfect analogy. Like, how does that actually work?
Well, on paper, it does look like a total genre mismatch. But if you look at the underlying mechanics, you see that Game Freak didn't actually abandon their expertise.
Okay, so what did they do?
They just applied it to a completely different framework. The gameplay isn't just standard hack and slash. Yeah, the entire combat system relies on a continuous loop of switching control back and forth between Emma and Koo.
Oh, wait, so the dog isn't just like an AI follower getting stuck on the environment while you do all the fighting.
No, not at all. You are actively controlling both. You're managing their synergy to exploit enemy weaknesses and even solve puzzles. Think about what Game Freak has mastered over 35 years. It's the psychology and the mechanics of creature companions.
Right, of course. Building bonds with the monsters.
Exactly. They understand how players bond with non-human characters and utilize their distinct abilities in tandem. They just translated that deep institutional knowledge of companion dynamics into a real-time format.
Oh, wow. That actually makes total sense when you frame it like that.
Yeah, and they also built in that reincarnation mode, right?
Oh, yeah. Where Emma temporarily absorbs specific powers, it adds a totally different rhythm to the standard stamina management combat we usually see in the Souls-like genre.
Which really just proves that deep specialization in one very specific mechanic, in this case, companion synergy, can allow a studio to successfully penetrate a completely saturated genre.
That's a great point. And speaking of studios successfully penetrating markets and just like shifting the entire industry's center of gravity, independent developers are doing the same thing on a global scale.
Oh, you're talking about Blackmyth?
Yeah.
Wukong.
Yes. Look at the milestone Wukong just hit. 30 million copies sold.
It's massive. Just to put that into perspective for you, the game sold 20 million copies in its first month back in August 2024.
Right.
Now, 2 years later, Game Science's title sits comfortably alongside Western titans like Elden Ring.
It's incredible. It's built on Unreal Engine 5, and it's generated an estimated $1.8 billion in revenue, with 70% of those sales happening on PC.
The PC market for this is just huge.
Yeah. And the gameplay is entirely anchored by the shape-shifting Rui Jingu Bang staff. You shrink it down for rapid light strikes and then enlarge it for massive, staggering damage.
It's a brilliant mechanic. But honestly, the financial success is actually secondary to the structural shift this game caused in its home market.
The ripple effect.
Exactly. The cultural and economic ripple effect is the real story here. The sources include a statement from GameScience CEO Fengji. He notes, and I quote, "This game showed we can introduce our cultural stories to the world and succeed."
Which is a huge deal for the Chinese market.
It is. Prior to Wukong, the Chinese gaming market was notoriously entrenched in a very specific business model. It was heavily dominated by mobile, free-to-play titles driven by aggressive microtransactions.
Right. The ultimate walled gardens designed entirely around constant small financial extraction.
Exactly. Wukong completely broke that highly lucrative addiction loop. It proved that a premium, one-time purchase model.
Like just a standard $60 game with zero microtransactions.
Right. It proved that Wukong could not only survive, but generate nearly $2 billion. It demonstrated that focusing on cultural specificity, specifically the Journey to the West narrative, could translate into a massive global hit.
And without needing a Western publisher to sanitize it for a broader audience, right?
Precisely. Which fundamentally alters how investors view risk in that region.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So we are seeing a pivot.
An enormous one. We are now seeing massive capital pivoting away from mobile gacha games and pouring into single-player, narrative-heavy investments from studios like Everstone, and even massive conglomerates like Tencent.
Wow.
They are specializing in high-end, culturally rich experiences because Wukong proved the global appetite for that specific niche is massive.
Okay, but this raises a huge question for me. If independent studios like Game Science no longer need a massive Western publisher to reach 30 million players, how do the legacy gatekeepers survive?
That is the multi-billion-dollar question.
Great. And you can actually see Sony's desperate answer to that question in this month's PlayStation Plus extra lineup.
Yeah, the August 2026 lineup is a surprisingly aggressive offering.
Very aggressive, especially considering their recent strategy of relying heavily on back catalog titles. I mean, just a month ago, they were coasting, giving subscribers Grand Theft Auto V for what feels like the fifth time.
Literally.
But for August 2026, they are dropping Dying Light 2. Reloaded Edition, which includes the new Tower expansion, that is a massive $50 AAA zombie parkour game.
And that's not all.
No. Alongside that, they added Big Walk, which is a PS5 exclusive walking simulator that relies heavily on the DualSense haptic feedback.
So you can literally feel the texture of the surfaces you are walking on.
Yeah, which sounds so cool. And they also included Signalis, this brilliant, highly philosophical, retro pixel survival horror game starring a robot named Elster.
Okay, so if you step back and look at that, this is a direct counterplay to what we saw earlier with Game Freak.
How so?
Well, Beast of Reincarnation launching day one on Xbox Game Pass is a huge acquisition for Microsoft. Sony recognizes that when independent studios can generate billions on their own and competitors are scoring day one AAA titles,
they can't afford to offer a stagnant library.
Exactly. They are practically giving away a $50 game like Dying Light 2 because they are forced to curate a buffet of highly specialized experiences just to justify the monthly subscription fee.
Right. So you get massive open world action, haptic driven indie narratives, and niche pixel horror all in one place.
They have to prove the walled garden is still the most efficient way to access variety.
And that tension between the massive centralized platform trying to keep you inside and the localized specialized tools giving you a reason to leave, That is exactly what is happening in the artificial intelligence sector this week, too.
The parallels are absolutely undeniable.
Right. Gaming is pushing high-end processing directly to our local drives, and AI is doing the exact same thing on our desktops.
That's true.
Just yesterday, August 10th, 2026, Meta released their Muse Glimmer AI.
This is a big deal.
A huge deal. This is a 30 billion parameter model that rivals the 2023 version of GPT-4 in both complex reasoning and code generation.
But the kicker is, it runs locally.
Exactly. It operates completely offline, on your own consumer hardware, no cloud fees, no internet connection required.
Which is a massive step away from the centralized, subscription-based models that have dominated the AI narrative for the last few years.
Okay, but here is my pushback on this. The hardware requirements are severe.
They are pretty steep.
Meta states you need at least an NVIDIA RTX 4070 GPU with 12 gigabytes of VRAM, alongside 32 gigs of system RAM. So I look at this so-called democratization narrative, and it feels a bit hollow.
How do you mean?
It's like Meta is handing you the keys to a free Ferrari, but telling you that you have to build a custom, highly expensive garage first to park it.
That's a fair point.
Right. It feels like a regression to the late 90s when we all had to buy massive, expensive desktop towers just to participate. Is this really democratization if the barrier to entry is still thousands of dollars? Aren't we just trading a software cloud monopoly for an NVIDIA hardware monopoly?
Well, that is a critical distinction to make. The upfront hardware tax is undeniably high, and NVIDIA certainly benefits from this shift. But what's fascinating here is the mechanics of ownership. They fundamentally change the power dynamic.
Okay, so it's not just about the cost.
No, we are shifting from a rental economy to an ownership economy. Previously, to access GPT-4 level logic, you were tethered to a $20 monthly fee forever.
Right, the subscription trap.
And more importantly, you were tethered to a cloud provider's terms of service.
And their data collection policy.
Exactly. Muse Glimmer is an open weight model, meaning you are downloading the actual neural weights, the brain of the AI itself.
Okay, so it's physically on my machine.
Yes. So when you ask it to analyze a confidential legal contract or sort through personal financial data, that information never leaves your physical machine. You bypass OpenAI's servers entirely.
Oh, wow. That is a big deal for privacy.
Huge. The democratization isn't about the technology being cheap. It's about you, the user, holding the absolute authority over your own data and computational privacy. You become the independent operator of your own intelligence tool.
Okay, that structural shift does make sense. You buy the hardware once and you start paying the digital rent.
Precisely.
But if you have this powerful private AI agent running locally on your machine, it still needs to access the outside world to be useful, right?
Yeah.
Like, it has to pull current information.
It absolutely does, okay. Which brings us to a really fascinating release from Cloudflare.
Yes, this blew my mind. On August 6th, they launched Kitesurf, which the sources describe as a web browser engineered specifically for AI agents.
It is the perfect example of how the infrastructure of the internet is specializing to accommodate this exact shift toward local AI.
So Kitesurf is a headless browser written in Rust in just 12 weeks. And when we say headless, we mean it has no graphical interface.
Zero graphics.
Right. There are no tabs, no bookmarks, no support for Canvas or WebGL. It was built using V8 isolates.
Which basically allows them to run the code securely and independently without loading a bulky full browser environment.
Exactly. And the result is a tool that uses 3 to 7 times less CPU and memory than Chromium. I mean, this is a browser with no screen, like a restaurant that only has a drive-thru for robots.
That's a great visual. Because an AI agent doesn't need to see the layout of a web page.
Right. It doesn't care about the font.
It doesn't care if the CSS renders beautifully or if the interactive animations load. It only needs the underlying data.
But the sources note Kitesurf is 2 to 3 times faster than Puppeteer.
Puppeteer being an older automated testing tool that developers have been using to scrape the web.
Right. But Puppeteer still loads way too much overhead. So if Kitesurf is this lightweight and this fast, my immediate thought is weaponization.
Yeah, the deuce potential.
Exactly. What stops a single user from deploying 10,000 local AI shopping assistants to scrape prices across the internet, effectively launching a massive DDoS attack and taking down small websites by overwhelming their servers with bot traffic?
And that is the exact friction point developers are debating right now.
Mm.
But Cloudflare built in mitigation strategies at the network level.
Okay, what?
Well, Kitesurf utilizes strict rate-limiting suspicious behavior detection, and it rigidly adheres to rules established in a website's robots.txt file.
Okay, so it plays nice, theoretically.
Theoretically. But the larger, so what for you listening to this is that the existence of this tool signals a profound structural change in how the web operates.
It changes who the internet is actually built for.
Exactly. The internet has always been a human-readable space, right? Designed for eyeballs, mouse clicks, and aesthetic engagement.
Yeah, visual consumption.
But as tools like Muse, Glimmer, and Kitesurf become standardized, the web is transitioning into a machine-readable database.
Mm.
You won't manually browse an airline's website anymore.
Wait, really?
No, your local AI will use Kitesurf to instantly query the underlying data structures of 50 different airlines, filter the results, and present you with the optimal choice.
That's wild. The entire internet is effectively becoming an API for our personal local AI tools.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? We have game studios pushing massive self-contained experiences to our local drives.
Right.
We have Meta handing us open-weight AI models to run privately in our home offices. We have Cloudflare giving those local models the specialized tools they need to autonomously extract data from the web.
The cloud is definitely stepping back.
We are taking physical ownership of our digital tools. But, as we mentioned at the top of the show, local control means local responsibility.
Yes. You no longer have a massive tech conglomerate managing your security protocols behind the scenes. When you hold the keys, you hold the liability.
Which brings us to the final and, frankly, catastrophic story from this week's sources.
This one is rough.
Very rough. Between late July and early August 2026, hackers executed the largest hardware wallet theft in history.
Incredible scale.
They stole over $130 million in Bitcoin. That's roughly 1,850 Bitcoin-draining funds from over 4,500 different addresses.
And they did it by exploiting a cold card hardware wallet.
Right. And cold card is supposed to be the Fort Knox of crypto. A device engineered with the sole explicit purpose of providing impenetrable cold storage for cryptocurrency.
It's a devastating blow to that reputation.
It's a catastrophic design flaw for a device whose literal only purpose is offline security. The entire value proposition of a cold wallet is that the private keys never touch the internet.
Exactly. That's the whole point.
Even if your computer is completely compromised by malware, your Bitcoin is supposed to remain safe inside the device. It's like buying an impenetrable, state-of-the-art titanium vault, but the manufacturer accidentally left the hinges on the outside.
And then you ignored the letter telling you how to fix it.
Right. So how does a piece of unhackable hardware fail so spectacularly because of a software glitch? How does an offline piece of hardware get systematically drained?
Well, it traces back to a deep vulnerability in the bootloader of older cold card models, specifically the MK2 and MK3 versions released prior to 2021.
Okay, so the bootloader.
The bootloader is the tiny foundational piece of software that runs before the actual operating system of the device even boots up.
Got it.
Security researchers discovered a flaw where if an attacker had 15 to 30 minutes of uninterrupted physical access to the device, they could interface directly with the hardware.
And do what?
Extract the seed phrase, the master password, to the wallet before the secure chip locked it down.
But wait, the hackers drained 4,500 addresses? How do you get 15 to 30 minutes of physical access to that many separate hardware wallets?
They executed a highly coordinated supply chain and social engineering attack.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the hackers heavily exploited the secondhand market. They were intercepting devices sold on places like eBay, compromising them, and then reselling them to users who thought they were getting a discount.
That is terrifying.
It gets worse. They also deployed targeted phishing campaigns. They sent forged emails that tricked users into mailing their devices to fake addresses for, quote-unquote, mandatory warranty repairs.
Oh, wow. People actually mailed them in.
Yes. And once the hackers had the device, they extracted the seed phrase, mailed it back to the user, and simply waited for the user to deposit funds.
That is incredibly bold. But the detail in the sources that really highlights the danger of this new era is the timeline of this whole thing.
Right, the patch.
Yes. The manufacturer, CoinKite, actually identified this flaw and released a firmware patch for it, version 4.0.0, and they released that patch way back in 2021.
The fix existed for 5 years.
5 years. But thousands of users completely ignored the firmware update.
It's tragic, really.
They bought the physical hardware, assumed the object itself provided the security, and walked around with a compromised vault for half a decade.
And that right there is the crux of the issue. The sources include an incredibly relevant quote from Bitcoin expert Andreas Antonopoulos regarding this exact incident.
What did he say?
He states, "We can't assume hardware alone guarantees security. And honestly, that single sentence encapsulates the entire shift we are analyzing today.
Yeah, it really does. Whether you are running a private 30 billion parameter AI model on your own NVIDIA graphics card, or you are holding millions of dollars on a localized piece of plastic and silicon, the burden of maintenance rests entirely on your shoulders.
Exactly. Think about it. When your life lived in the cloud, companies like Google, Meta, and your bank employed entire divisions of cybersecurity engineers.
Right, to silently patch vulnerabilities while you were asleep.
You were a completely passive consumer of their security. But when you demand the autonomy of open-weight AI models and self-custody financial wallets, you essentially fire those engineers and you would inherit the job of the IT department.
Yeah. You have to know how to flash a bootloader. You have to actively monitor for firmware patches. You have to vet your supply chains to ensure you aren't buying compromised hardware.
The freedom of democratization fundamentally requires the discipline of active participation. Yeah. You just cannot rely on ambient, centralized systems to protect you anymore.
Wow. What an incredibly dense snapshot of the tech landscape this week.
It's been a busy one.
Truly. We watched Game Freak shatter a 35-year tradition to deliver Beast of Reincarnation while Black Myth. Wukong proved that a localized premium cultural narrative could dismantle established market loops and generate billions.
And we saw Sony weaponizing their PS Plus library to maintain their walled garden against those very shifts.
Yep. And we tracked the profound decentralization of the web itself, with Meta's Muse Glimmer running complex AI on consumer hardware and Cloudflare's Kitesurf transforming the internet into a machine-readable database.
All of it culminating in the sobering reality of the cold card hack, which proves that taking ownership of your digital assets inherently means taking ownership of your own vulnerabilities.
It's a huge trade-off.
It is. And the core takeaway for you listening to this is that passive consumption is becoming a liability.
Absolutely.
As we transition into this highly distributed tech landscape, your best defense against both information overload and severe security threats is active, informed participation in how your local tools operate. Like simply updating your firmware.
Exactly. The cloud isn't floating away. It's just condensing into the hardware sitting right on our desk.
Beautifully put.
Thanks. Which leaves you with one final thing to chew on today. As these legacy gatekeepers hand over the keys and provide us with incredibly powerful tools that live exclusively on our own devices, are we truly gaining digital freedom, or are we just becoming unpaid IT administrators for our own personal infrastructure? Something to mull over before you hit remind me later on your next software update. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.